The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Hello and welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm here with Maximilian Bolk and Guy Giuffredi to talk about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. We've reached episode 56, recording this on Thursday at noon. This podcast is sponsored by our two partners, the Economic Development Agency of the Canton of Bern and the law firm Wenger Vielli. Guy, what's on the agenda today?
We've got some exciting news again this week. We'll kick off with yet another record broken in 2025 and an interview with Peter Thiel. Our main topic is a deep dive into the deep tech report that was published last week. And for the listener question, we'll discuss fundraising tactics used by founders. Finally, we'll look at Boost Inc.'s 15 million Swiss francs Series B.
Right. But first, a quick heads up. Two more deals happened in the last few hours. One involves Beekeeper, which was acquired by Lumapps. And then we had the $162 million round by Climeworks, a positive surprise after recent negative headlines. Partners Group doubled down and participated again. We're still gathering news and input and may be able to share more about those deals next week. We've received some interesting tips, but need to verify them first. Let's start with the first piece of news from the share register. Never before have so many new companies been founded in Switzerland in the first half of the year, over 28,000, which is a 6% increase compared to last year. Particularly interesting, the strongest growth came from the cantons of Zug, Valais, and Geneva. That shows entrepreneurship is alive and well despite geopolitical uncertainty and a weakening economy. Guy, we're seeing rising incorporation figures, but also a tougher VC environment. How do you explain this boom?
We may need to break those numbers down. The 28,000 companies, that's huge. But of those, the ones backed by VCs are only around 0.5%, far less than 1%. This number mostly indicates that the entrepreneurial spirit is strong in Switzerland, with many people wanting to go independent or open something like a new restaurant. The 28,000 includes all sole proprietorships, GmbHs, AGs, including those used just as holding structures. So I wouldn't directly link this founding boom to the VC landscape, because as we know, only a very small number of companies are truly VC relevant. That underscores how few startups are actually suitable for venture funding.
But would you say the quality of new startups is increasing, or are we seeing a wave of low capital, low ambition companies?
Low capital doesn't automatically mean low ambition. There are many companies now saying, we don't want VC funding, we want to bootstrap and build the business ourselves. So I wouldn't say there's a drop in quality. There are definitely high potential companies being founded this year. And when looking at quality, you have to evaluate the vintage of the founding year. You need to look back and see how many companies founded in a given year were liquidated or went bankrupt. Right now, we're seeing more bankruptcies among companies founded between 2019 and 2022. We'll be able to look back in 3 years to assess whether 2025 was a strong vintage. Let's hope it is, and that we welcome many great founders to the ecosystem.
It would be interesting to compare the bankruptcy rate to the total number of new incorporations. How does that ratio change over time? As you said, most of these new companies aren't for VCs. Most are craftspeople, hair salons, insurance brokers, consultants of all kinds. Consulting seems to be the most common profession. Everyone can call themselves a consultant. So you're right. Of those 28,000, probably only about 0.5% are truly investable. Maybe even just 0.15%. Still a solid number if you calculate it. I agree with your view. Overall, definitely positive for the economy. People are still starting companies despite the tough macro environment, and that's a good sign. But from a VC perspective, it doesn't necessarily mean there are more investable opportunities. Just because more startups are being founded doesn't mean there are more VC-ready ones. That's important to point out. All right, on to Peter Thiel. As you said in the intro, the Silicon Valley investor, Trump supporter, and Palantir co-founder gave an interview to the New York Times, I think it was on Saturday, and really outdid himself again. We'll share the link in the show notes. We definitely recommend giving it a listen. You don't have to agree with his views, of course, but it's certainly worth hearing. He talks about his fear of a technological antichrist, the influence of AI, transhumanism, and why AI is also a spiritual matter for him. Reactions range from raised eyebrows to outright shock. But as is often the case with Tael, somewhere between madness and foresight, there's a trend hidden in there. He's been polarizing for years, but how seriously should we take these kinds of statements from a VC perspective?
I did listen to the interview, a full hour-long chat with the New York Times. Some interesting takes, I must say. He really pushes his getting back to the future narrative. He says society has stagnated for 50 years and is now stuck. With this, he takes aim at everyone. I personally wouldn't take everything he says literally, but it's worth hearing. He also explains why he backed Trump, not because of political alignment, but to disrupt society and break away from the typical Bush-Obama-Biden cycle of stagnation. He hoped this would positively impact the VC scene by encouraging more risk-taking, more moonshots, actually landing on the moon. Tough topics, but an interesting interview. I wouldn't base my investment decisions on it, though.
What does this interview reveal about the mindset in Silicon Valley? Peter Thiel is also a founder of Founders Fund, a well-known VC. How different is that mindset compared to European tech?
I took a few notes. In Silicon Valley, it's clear technology is an ideology. Peter Thiel, like many others there, sees AI as a way out of stagnation and a path to real progress. They believe in this radically in Silicon Valley. Progress must be forced in a way. Move fast and break things, and that's their motto. They're far more risk-tolerant than we are in Europe. On the topic of transhumanism you mentioned, I'd say the boundary between man and machine is far more fluid in the Valley. They see AI as potential of immortal vessel for the human mind, not physical, but for our knowledge and intellect. In Europe, we're much more cautious. More regulation, more ethical debate, more emphasis on social integration and sustainability. We proudly wave those flags. So yes, there's a real difference in mentality. In Silicon Valley, the question is, what if it works? In Europe, we ask the same question, but quickly follow it up with, what could go wrong? Or how can this spin out of control? That's the difference.
And I can really recommend Peter Thiel's book, 0 to 1. I always recommend it to my students because it clearly illustrates the idea that there are zero startups, the copycats of this world, or startups operating in non-disruptive fields. And then there are the one startups that from the beginning aim to transform entire industries and create monopolistic structures where they are essentially the sole leader. If you look at Peter Thiel's investments, for example, the companies he co-founded like PayPal or later Palantir, he always entered spaces where he was far ahead of the curve, a frontrunner. That theme runs throughout his investment logic to find the one startup. That's why the Founders Fund makes very few investments, far fewer than what portfolio theory would suggest. Not 25 to 30 investments, but more like 10, with large tickets and high conviction. Each one is a bet on a disruptive case that can truly change the world. Highly interesting, I can definitely recommend the book. As I said, you don't have to agree with everything. For example, Thiel supports the enhanced games. It's essentially the Olympic Games where all doping is allowed. I've made my views on that pretty clear in former episodes. Still, while Peter Thiel provokes, he also brings up some important, thought-provoking ideas, and those ideas are worth discussing. I've had long evenings debating nothing but Peter Thiel's theses with others, and it never got boring. There are always people who swim against the current and find it fascinating, while others think it's dangerous to even hold such views.
Whether you're founding or relocating a company in the canton of Bern, the Bern Economic Development Agency supports entrepreneurs and businesses with advisory and funding programs, helping to strengthen the regional economy. Wenger and Vieli, your partner law firm for startups. Whether you're incorporating, raising a financing round, or preparing for exit, startups face complex legal challenges. Wenger and Vieli supports founders in every phase of their journey with tailored legal advice on corporate law, financing, tax, and IP protection. Wenger and Vieli, your legal advisors for startups.
Let's move on to this week's main topic. Today, we're looking at the brand new Swiss Deep Tech Report 2025, published by Deep Tech Nation Switzerland in collaboration with Dealroom and Startup Ticker. In a nutshell, Switzerland is globally among the top when it comes to science to business innovation. We read and discuss the report. 60% of all Swiss venture capital between 2019 and 2025 went into deep tech, the highest in Europe and globally ranked third per capita. Funding has nearly seven times in just 10 years, from under $300 million to an estimated $2.3 billion in 2025. ETH and EPFL are among Europe's top five deep tech spin-out factories. Only Oxford and Cambridge rank higher. Over 1,500 startups in Switzerland operate in deep tech fields. Topics like AI and machine learning account for 23% of all new ventures since 2021. Robotics, tech bio, and climate and energy are also showing strong growth momentum. Swiss startups generated a combined enterprise value of over $100 billion. International VCs dominate late-stage rounds with a 96% share. Local investors are mainly active at the early stage. As a result, they often see little return at the time of exit. A bit provocative, but probably not far from the truth. Why does this matter? Because Switzerland proves that excellent fundamental research can be commercialized at scale. Deep tech, once a niche, is now the backbone of Swiss innovation. International capital relies on Swiss startups. But this also increases pressure to mobilize more domestic late-stage capital. That would be crucial. With a focus on mission-critical areas like AI, climate, and health, Switzerland is positioning itself as a global deep tech player with potential for all of Europe. Let's dive into the discussion. The report shows that 60% of Swiss venture capital flows into deep tech, globally unique. Why is there such a strong focus in Switzerland? What are we doing better than others?
We have an outstanding research ecosystem, ETH, EPFL, and other global innovation hubs based in Switzerland. In recent years, we've placed great emphasis on generating spin-offs and turning innovation into companies. There's a clear focus on tackling hard problems. Swiss founders often work on socially relevant and complex issues. They dig deep with Swiss precision. Also, Switzerland is a relatively small market for platforms or B2C models, so it makes sense that with such strong innovation engines, our country focuses on investing in globally scalable topics. And I'd also say, in the past 10 years, we've built a very strong early-stage support system in Switzerland, with InnoSuisse, Bridge, VentureKick, Gebert Ruf, Devigier, etc. It's well set up for deep tech incubation.
Swiss startups have created over $100 billion in enterprise value, but 96% of the big deals are funded from abroad. Is that a problem for Switzerland, or just a sign that our ecosystem has matured?
Yes, it is a problem. 96% is a huge number. The issue doesn't start in the late stage. It starts already in early stage funding. The longer we manage to keep the team and the IP in Switzerland, the better for our ecosystem and for Switzerland as a place of business. We have the talent here, and when an exit happens, even if late-stage capital comes from abroad, we want the founders to be still entrenched in the Swiss ecosystem. And we often see that founders who exit successfully reinvest into the ecosystem. People like David Alleman from Ontario, Raphael Oberholzer from NIO, Joel Ross from Way, they invest in startups and share their know-how with new founders. That helps drive the VC flywheel forward.
We heard that machine learning accounts for almost a quarter of all deals, followed by robotics, tech bio, and climate tech. From your perspective, what's the most exciting segment long-term?
If we break it down, in the next 5 to 8 years, AI and ML are likely to be the most exciting areas. These companies can be built quickly and scale well. Trillions in value creation are expected in this sector. In biotech, traditionally a Swiss strength, we still see great potential. But unfortunately, many companies are sold too early, and the late-stage value creation doesn't stay in Switzerland. Sure, a $1 billion exit is nice, but we rarely see companies become giants like Roche or Novartis. Climate tech and robotics are also extremely strong in Switzerland. Long-term, these are fields where we could establish ourselves as a global super player. And you didn't mention this, but I'll add a fifth category, quantum. It's still in its early days, but Switzerland has world-class research. If we do everything right from the start, we could become a globally significant player in quantum.
I think it's obvious we have a late-stage capital gap. What needs to happen so that more domestic capital flows into scale-ups? It's so clear this is a disadvantage for Switzerland. Every country in the world has understood that late-stage funding is crucial. If the private sector won't do it, maybe the state needs to step in, like in Germany. But it's crazy. We do the training, we fund the fundamental research, we incubate, we finance, and then when it gets exciting, we check out and don't care what happens next. I mean, come on. Try to decode that for me. What is the root of the problem?
To put it provocatively, it's almost an insult to taxpayers. We invest massive amounts in primary research, and then when it transitions to entrepreneurship, we give away the value that was actually created. There are different levers. We talk about this a lot. It's an extremely relevant topic. For example, pension funds are allowed to invest in private equity and venture capital, but they still don't. You could say, we gave you 5 years to prepare. Now you must allocate at least 1% of your assets to these classes in the next 5 years. That alone would be a huge lever. Another idea would be a sovereign fund, some billions in state capital that either invests directly into funds or matches investments by Swiss outfits. If we at Koyo invest 3 million Swiss francs, another 3 million Swiss francs could come in as non-dilutive grants. That would be a useful mechanism. Of course, you can also create tax incentives. In the UK, the tax landscape is different than in Switzerland, and business and family offices are really encouraged to invest in tech companies. We could apply similar principles here. For example, if they invest 15 to 20 million Swiss francs per year in VC, they could enjoy certain benefits. So that's three levers to begin with. And of course, there are many more.
And we need more funds like Koyo that invest in later stages. That's crucial. But these funds also need LPS willing to invest in them. What I've noticed is that many Swiss investors prefer direct investments, which often don't perform well, as it's a complex skill, or they invest in pre-seed funds. Those are attractive because of the feel-good themes. Building something new, getting involved early, and telling people in your circle that you're investing in cool ideas. But I think, going forward, what we really need in Switzerland are late-stage funds, and those need to be funded by Swiss LPs, by Swiss capital. That's why I believe in our positioning. We'll see. In a few years. Or in 12. Just kidding. In 10 years, when the fund closes, we'll do a full review. Hopefully by then, we'll have 10,000 listeners per episode on Burn Rate. Likely more if we keep going.
Exactly. And one more thing. This trend of investing in pre-seed funds, I don't want to talk badly about them, but sometimes it feels like venture philanthropy done by the LPs. There's a desire to support something meaningful, but VC still isn't seen as an actual asset class with strong return potential. We need to change that narrative. And that means funds have to perform. Once investors start seeing that VC generates outperformance compared to other asset classes, like public equities, then that perception will shift. But getting there requires work from all of us.
All right, let's move on to the listener question. It comes from Lena in Basel and touches a sensitive topic that's rarely discussed in public. How much strategy is allowed in fundraising, and where does it cross into manipulation? It's about a tactic many founders know. When you're talking to investors and want to create momentum, you say something like, "We're almost full, we're only looking for strategic partners now." Sounds good, but it's often a bit premature. Is that a clever lie in fundraising? It's rarely provably false, but it creates a psychological effect. It creates artificial scarcity, activates FOMO, fear of missing out, and can turn a hesitant, "let me think about it," into a signed term sheet. So, is it just smart positioning or manipulative? Where's the line between strategic framing and intentional deception? And how should we as investors respond? That's definitely a juicy question. Guy, how often do you encounter this kind of fundraising tactic? When a founder says, "the round is almost full," how do you read that?
You hear that all the time. The round is full, but I can give you one last ticket. It's part of the standard playbook for founders trying to close their round quickly. There's usually no malicious intent. They're just trying to push to generate momentum. They say it to all investors, hoping one commits, and then the domino effect kicks in. Once one signs, others follow, and traction builds. When I hear that, I calmly ask, what exactly does this interest consist of? Do you have any soft commitments? Any signed term sheets? You've talked to many investors. Where do you stand with each of them? Are you at the investment committee stage, still in the analyst round? Which business angels are involved? They don't even have to name names. I just want to gauge the temperature. If a founder stays vague or starts fumbling, that's a flag for me. That's just signaling, trying to pressure me. And if they're not honest at that early stage, that's a breach of trust. You have to be very careful how you handle strategic signaling.
I don't get it at all. When someone tells me the round is almost full, my first question is, how full? If the answer is 20%, then, well, you just lied. Then I ask, who's in the round? And if they say, I can't tell you, then it's over. I'm out. So that phrase, the round is almost full, has zero effect on me. It's just not effective. Any rational investor will want to know more. Who else is on the cap table? Who's the lead? What are the terms? That question leads nowhere, and I don't even blame the founders for trying. It's just a clumsy attempt to create pressure. I don't find it very smart. Maybe the founder even loses credibility indirectly, but in terms of impact, it has zero influence on my decision. So, Guy, where do you personally draw the line between clever signaling and deliberate deception? Are there any no-goes for you in a fundraising pitch?
Yes, definitely. A big no-go is when someone says, investor X is investing, they're committing this much, and it's simply not true. I know most of the VC investors in Switzerland. I have their numbers and emails. So I might just call and ask, hey, are you investing? If they say, we're nowhere near that stage, then I know the founder lied. That's a blatant lie. And when that happens, I walk away from the deal. Last year, I had a case. They were pushing hard, said they had an oversubscribed pre-seed round of 850,000 Swiss francs with multiple signed CLAs, convertible loan agreements, and that I'd be a great final fit. I asked them to send over the CLA so I could review the terms. It took weeks before they sent the first one. They claimed it was backed by a top lead investor, but it turned out to be part of some kind of loose conglomerate, and I said thanks, but no thanks. The case itself was actually cool, but I felt deceived. That happens once and then I'm out for good.
With investors, that's one thing, but sometimes it also happens with customers. Founders claiming to have first customers, pilot projects, or advisory boards. I actually had a case less than 2 weeks ago. A startup sent me a pitch deck with a very impressive advisory board. Really impressive names. By coincidence, I knew one of the people listed. I asked them, hey, why are you on this advisory board? And they replied, I've never even heard of this startup. They had added this person without asking, which is outrageous. Probably not illegal, but definitely cheeky. For me, that's a red flag. Even if there's no bad intent or legal violation, it's simply not acceptable. So for me, no-go number one in a pitch, always tell the truth. If you don't know something, admit it. There's no shame in not knowing, but please don't claim credit you haven't earned. Lies have short legs. Of course, it gets critical when you look at the Theranos case. There, for example, customer names were mentioned in investor pitches, but they weren't actually customers. That was later uncovered, and it's one of the reasons the founder ended up in prison. She's still serving a sentence of about 7 years. Maybe if she's lucky, she'll get out with an ankle monitor in a year or two and serve the rest under house arrest. Or maybe Trump will pardon her, though that's unlikely because she was clearly a Democrat when she was on the cover of Forbes. So she backed the wrong horse that time. It's dangerous. I had an interesting conversation with a lawyer this week who told me once a term sheet is signed, especially in the US, the pitch deck and business plan often become part of the legal documentation. It's appended to the shareholder's agreement. That means if you lie in your deck and it becomes part of the contract, you're legally liable. So don't do it. It's not worth it. The chance that these things come to light is high, and the chance of consequences is growing. Not just in the US, but increasingly in Switzerland too. Now the question, can you create pressure without manipulation? Let's say a founder has started fundraising but isn't gaining momentum, speaking with lots of investors. How can this founder still create healthy urgency? What would you recommend?
Yeah, that's not easy. you really need to convince with facts. One way is to be transparent. Hopefully, you've talked to many investors already and there's some interest. You can present that like a sales funnel. That shows there's traction. Investors will notice, okay, seven others are heading toward due diligence. If I want in, I need to move. If you don't have that after months of trying, maybe it's time to go back to the office and build customer traction. Show that the product actually works. You create real urgency when you show 20 to 30% monthly growth. That's when investors feel they need to act. Otherwise, the valuation may jump or another investor might take the lead. It's better to say clearly, we're closing the round by the end of Q3. That works better than saying we're almost full when it's not true. Then send updates. We added seven new customers, two new investors are coming on board. That's how you draw investors in with facts.
Walk the talk is definitely a good strategy. Keep following up. Stay top of mind with potential investors. That absolutely makes sense. The most important thing, in my view, is to secure a strong lead investor with a good reputation. Then it usually goes fast. So don't communicate too much too early. First, win the lead. Once you have that, the rest follows. If you don't have a lead, I think it's very hard to create time pressure, especially post-2021, when deals used to be signed in 24 hours. Now it's the opposite. At Koyo, we say upfront, we need at least 3 months. That might sound extreme, but I like to take my time, do thorough due diligence, talk to the founders 10 times. Only once I've built high conviction do I invest, either my own money or the fund's money. That's the right approach, I think. So dear founders, and dear Lena, thanks for the great question. Think carefully about how you want to build and maintain pressure. Our deal of the week comes from Zurich. And this time, it's a topic we all know from daily life, vending machines. Boost Inc., also known as Boost Bar, just raised 16 million euros in a Series B, led by Diretissima Growth Partners, with participation from Capnamic Technologies and Kineo Capital. Vending machines, really?
Well, indeed, it's vending machines, a true growth case. But Boost isn't your typical chips and Coke machine we used to see at train stations. You remember? The ones with soda, cigarettes, whatever you needed late at night. Boost is different. They're trying to establish a new category. Smart, digitally controlled micro canteens that can be flexibly stocked with salad, sandwiches, espresso, whatever. The goal is to make unattended food service in offices more efficient, and the demand is real, especially in this post-COVID hybrid work world. They've managed to build solid traction.
I asked provocatively, but I actually think it's a fascinating topic. As you know, I invest privately outside the fund too, low-tech, things like bakeries or future kitchens. So of course, Boost interests me. The founders, Pascal Ufer and Johannes Lehrmann, started by retrofitting old vending machines with smart software. After the proof of market with early customers, they quickly moved to developing their own hardware. Now they have thousands of active locations, a team of 150 people, is that right? And customers like Hilton, Coca-Cola, and Siemens. To me, this is more than food tech. It's a platform bet.
They built their own vending machines, run a proprietary cloud platform called VendLive, if I'm reading this correctly. They try to predict customer behavior, what people will consume tomorrow or in the coming days, and how to stock each machine accordingly. That's what makes them attractive to brands and operators. They don't just sell products. They try to understand consumption. They aim to integrate data, logistics, and consumer experience into a seamless system, offering an operating system for unattended retail and food service.
Boost even positions itself explicitly as an alternative to the traditional office cafeteria. With hybrid work and smaller office teams, a fixed food service offering often doesn't make economic sense anymore. That's where Boost wants to come in. Founder Johannes Lehrmann says, anywhere traditional service isn't viable anymore. That's our market. And the market potential is huge. $70 billion globally in vending, one-third of it in Europe.
Yes, and the market today is still highly fragmented and underdeveloped in terms of tech. That's where the opportunity lies. But it's also a tough market. It's fragmented and often in locations where no one else wants to go. So the question is, will this become a standalone European champion? Or is it more likely a strategic exit to a catering company, a facility services provider, or even big tech? What do you think, Max?
Good question. KKR was active with Selecta, and there are two or three other similar providers in Switzerland. I won't name names. But yes, this could be a buy-and-build case. They could acquire small local vending operators, consolidate them into their platform. The model is scalable. In fact, in 2023, they already made their first acquisition in the UK, which gave their internationalization a massive boost.
They're able to leverage maintenance, logistics, service, and operations if they pursue a buy and build strategy. But let's quickly look at Boost's financing story. The company was founded in June 2020. In 2021, it raised a small round of 750,000 Swiss francs at a pre-money valuation of 5 million Swiss francs. Back then, Backbone Ventures led the round, with several well-known business angels participating. In 2023, they acquired Iguana, essentially a merger with this UK-based company.
That was followed by the Series A, raised across multiple closings in 2024, in which the company raised a total of 12 million Swiss francs. The valuation during that round ranged from 20 million Swiss francs to over 65 million Swiss francs, so the company clearly showed strong growth. The Series A was not heavily publicized, and even though we know who the investors are, we're not allowed to name them.
And now it's July 2025. The Series B has just been announced. In this round, Boost raised another 15 million Swiss francs at a post-money valuation of over 80 million Swiss francs. So this was essentially a flat round compared to the Series A. The pre-money valuation of the Series B was set at the post-money valuation of the Series A. The round was led by Diretissima Growth Partners, Capmont Technology also invested, and it was disclosed that Kineo Finance, the only existing investor we're allowed to name, also participated in this round.
Bottom line, Boost isn't a fancy AI startup, but it's building a relevant B2B platform in the food sector here in Switzerland. And that's definitely a positive takeaway. That's it for this episode of Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast. If you'd like to support us, subscribe to our newsletter and share the episode in your network. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Take care and goodbye.